Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormorant Strike as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kens, and today Lindsay, Pools, and I will be continuing our reread of Troubled Blood, this time for chapters 69 through 71. As always, please be warned that our discussion of Troubled Blood will reference events that occur later in the book, as well as previous books in the series. So we cast out a net for some fun questions. We had a few different ones that people sent in, but there was one we're going to talk about today that was a question from Joe on Twitter.
Not that Joe.
Yeah.
Please, Joe Rowling, send us questions on Twitter. Please. Come on and ask us questions, please.
Let us ask you questions.
Questions can flow back and forth.
From Joe, not Rowling. Joe wrote into us writing, "I've wondered for a long time whether JKR always intended for this to be a really slow burn romance or whether it has just evolved along the way as a side story and took on a life of its own. Was there attraction right from Cuckoo's Calling or was it just mutual curiosity?"
I feel like we are going to be unanimous on our answer for this one.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like 1, 2, 3, we all say it. 1, 2, 3,
intended.
I think we're all in agreement that it's intended.
Yeah. There are so many things in this book that confirm that, not to mention how things were phrased in the first book to begin with.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of foreshadowing in Cuckoo's Calling. The engagement ring going dark, things like, even in Cuckoo's Calling, I think we've mentioned this before, but Robin being possessive of Strike already in regards to, you know, when she found out he slept with Kiara, that was something she was very interested in.
Yeah, a question that J.K. Rowling gets asked often, and she was asked this recently too in doing an interview for The Christmas Pig, is about her writing process. And one of the things she almost always says is that before she even starts to write, she plans.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's absolutely intentional. And I don't even think that it's a side story in the way the question asks it, because if you ask me, like, yes, they're murder mysteries. Yes, it's crime fiction, but what are they about? Well, it's about their lives, right? And so much of it is about them growing and healing together. So
I absolutely agree. As novels, these are foremost about these two people and the way in which they've been damaged in the past and how that's affected their lives and how they're going to move forward and change and grow. And like you said, heal.
And the second part of the question, was there attraction right from Cuckoo's Calling or was it just mutual curiosity? I think we're given the answer to this.
Yeah. When Strike addresses her hairline the very first time they meet.
Yeah, and he even references it in Troubled Blood that he was attracted to her from the very first day. Her, no, because I'm just thinking of that line where she says to Matthew, he's not even remotely attractive.
I'm sure he's over 40. It's like, ouch. I wonder if she was exaggerating that a teensy bit for Matthew's benefit. You know,
probably. That's possible.
A little tiny bit.
But even then, she was still pretty curious about him.
Oh yeah.
In the beginning, even if she didn't recognize what it was, like she knew there was a part of her that was drawn to him.
Yeah. When she goes out looking for him after giving him that news about Charlotte getting engaged, I think we see there that she's already interested in him as a person and not just as a detective, not just as a means to the career she wants, right? Mm-hmm. She's intrigued by him, Cormoran, and wants to get to know him. But yeah, like you said, Joe is a planner.
She's actually said in something that stresses her out, the idea of just planning as you go. I'll have to find it.
The story of Strike and Robin and their relationship is too integral. It's woven too well into the plot to be a happy accident, in my opinion. It was a short question. Do we want to do number two as well? Let's do number two.
All right. This is from Terry Bo West 55 on Twitter. They wrote in, Charlotte is still around even if Strike decided to cut the link, since she always, you know, follows what happens to him. Do you think if a romance is confirmed with Robin, with Charlotte being unstable, could she become one of the villains in the book, given that she's so possessive of Strike?
I think she's a wild card. I don't think we have any idea what Charlotte's going to do.
Yeah.
I have a personal theory. Maybe this belongs in predictions. I don't know. But I think that, and this could be the main conflict of a book, I think that Charlotte is actually going to commit suicide, but make it look like a murder to frame Strike. Okay. And I have reasons because, well, one, that would be such a good way of messing with his life, right? If she knows she's never getting him back and he's moved on, then what better way to screw with him? make him feel guilty and ruin his life, basically. But two, we've already had how many murders made to look like suicides? Two at least.
Well, there's three. I think you could argue there's Lula Landry, there's Jasper Chisel, and there's Leda.
But you know what? Because there are so many parallels between Leda and Charlotte, this makes my theory even stronger. We're going to get the inverse, a suicide made to look like a murder. And Charlotte and Leda being sort of dark parallels, Leda murdered looks like suicide, Charlotte the other way around. I mean, what do you think? I think it's plausible.
I haven't had enough time to sit with this theory, but... My immediate reaction is I don't think so, just because she's already tried to do that and failed. So she's going to have her do that again and this time succeed. I don't know.
I have my own thoughts on that. And I'm not necessarily married to the idea, but I was thinking that Charlotte might give up on contacting Strike. I'm thinking that because Charlotte is so jealous of Robin, Robin still has Charlotte like living in her head. Charlotte knows there's something there. She's going to try and fuck with Robin and get in her head and like start twisting things around in there. Like, I could totally see her doing something like that.
I could absolutely see her doing something like that. You know, some people argue that Strike changing his number is going to be like Charlotte's a realization that she needs to stop, that she needs to, you know, help herself. But from what we know of Charlotte and her personality, I think it's only going to make her escalate her behavior. She might simmer and lie low for a bit, but in the long term, it's only going to make her try harder, in my opinion and experience with that kind of personality.
In my experience with that personality, if it's not fun anymore, they don't do it. But I'm sure there's got to be some sort of further resolution with Charlotte, especially with Robin.
Well, what's your opinion on the question itself? Do you think will she become a villain?
For me, I feel like the resolution needs to just be in Robin's own head. Mm-hmm. But who knows? I agree that we can't really predict anything with Charlotte because she's unpredictable.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you that resolution regarding Charlotte needs to happen for Robin up here. And that Charlotte herself doesn't actually need to be involved in that. That's more Strike needs to be involved in that resolution.
But it sure would be nice to see a Charlotte-Robin showdown, though.
Oh, I hate that. Sorry, Kens. Not to shoot you down, but oh, I hate that trope. I would rather see Robin be her amazing self and rescue Charlotte from something, and then Charlotte be conflicted and annoyed about it, and Robin taking the high road.
Some of the Charlotte prediction just feels a little soap opera-y to me.
Mm-hmm. She's kind of a soap opera of a person, though.
I'm talking about my suicide prediction.
Not just that. A lot of the Charlotte stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, well, do we want to get into chapter 69 then? What happens in this chapter is after his interview with Creed, Strike and Robin sort through everything they know over the phone and they start to make plans. The epigraph for this one is, "Bury ye the picture of that lady's head. Full lively is the semblance, though the substance dead."
This one is probably the one I have the most trouble with.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm still not completely sure. I mean, a picture of a lady's head, we have that with Joanna Hammond and the picture that Robin finds. So there's that. Yeah. The second part, "full lively is the semblance, though the substance dead." The only thing I can think is that Margot and Louise, they've both been missing. Some of their family may hope they're alive, but here they're talking about where they think both of their bodies are.
Well, because they're like alive in their heads.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. Both Louise and Margot in this, they are still, as you will, bearing them on their shields, right? They are fighting for justice for the images of these women, the memory of these women, even though they are both long gone and hidden still. But the memory that's driving them is still alive in their head. And I didn't catch the literal picture of a lady's head with the face mole.
Yeah, this is a tough one.
But then we get to talk about the aftermath of Strike being sexy and smart after his interview with Creed.
Are we going to be slightly less thirsty this episode? Did we work it all out last episode?
I make absolutely no promises.
I mean, yeah, fair enough.
I will break that promise immediately.
So last time I talked about how I imagined that Strike was the talk of Broadmoor. I just imagine it now. You know, he's the talk of the town, and Marvin is by far the most popular nurse around.
Marvin went straight to the water cooler. You will never guess what just happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Bijan must have been absolutely blown away. Like, he was not expecting Strike to succeed at all, right? He didn't even want the interview to happen, really.
No, and I don't know why I'm so interested in him and how he's feeling, but I don't know. It's just like, is he annoyed? Is he happy?
I was just imagining that everyone in that room who witnessed it was now like a little bit in love with Strike. And so he was shaken, being like, did this awaken something in me?
There's a fanfic for you.
Oh, my Lord.
Well, it would be a challenge. I'm intrigued now.
I take it back. Please don't put that in the world.
You think he'd be annoyed?
Well, just that I don't know how long he's been working with Creed, and yeah, for this guy to come in just off the street and 45 minutes later have a confession, maybe a little annoyed. Yeah.
That would be a bit of a blow to his professional ego. It's all right. He can write up the whole thing in a paper and get it published. He can take it to a conference as a case study.
Strike will love that.
With a pseudonym that's like totally obvious, like the interviewer, Mr. Strick.
Cameron Strick.
Strike's like, God damn it. I would go to that conference paper. I want to see Dr. Bijral's take on it.
Strike says he feels like he's been there twice as long as he actually had. Mm-hmm. Just have to imagine that experience was really draining.
All of it. Because all of the anticipation and the adrenaline and the anxiety beforehand.
And he's thinking about all of the victims and everything in between all of the interactions that he's having with Creed too. So God, talk about emotionally exhausting.
Do you guys both see Strike as an introvert? I kind of always have, but it's possible I'm projecting that a little bit. But I still think so.
I'm also an introvert, so I'm also in danger of projecting myself all over Strike. He does seem to value his alone time quite a bit. And he is always drained by going to family events. So I would tend to say, yeah, he is.
Yeah, I'm inclined to think that he's an introvert too. Though, again, I'm an introvert as well, so I'm also projecting.
So we're all three of us introverts are like, yes, Carmen is definitely an introvert. It's a very unbiased assessment.
I really do think he is, though.
I know. I do, too.
He definitely could be.
So introverted Strike feels a powerful need to place himself amongst other people.
Ordinary people.
Ordinary people going about their lives. I like how he has three wants. Robin is number two, right after food. But when it comes right down to it, he calls her even before he eats.
I know that Robin's his partner, and even if he wasn't in love with her, he would have wanted to call her and tell her what happened. But I do think part of that desire is a need for comfort, right?
100%. Absolutely. We have seen his tendency. He's even recognized it in himself that he calls Robin when he feels down or bored or lonely or sad or really any uncomfortable feeling. Or any positive feeling. His first instinct is to call Robin.
Pretty much if he's awake.
So at this point, it's like, you know what? He doesn't even need to acknowledge to himself like he has earlier that this is what he's doing. It's just automatic now, isn't it?
And when he calls Robin, she doesn't even say hello or hi. Just what happened?
Happened.
That's so cute.
I just love seeing this passion that they share. It's a connection that I don't think either of them have had before. I tend to think that Charlotte picks up on that, even though she's not around. And I wonder if Matthew ever did too.
I think he definitely did.
Charlotte would have to be bloody psychic to pick up on this. She's spoken to Strike like three times.
Well, no, because she can see them working together in the media. She knows that she's been there for almost 5 years now. So she has to know that they have a connection that she never was interested in sharing with him.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. And Strike committing to someone other than Charlotte for 5 years. She sees that Robin is a permanent part in his life, right?
A permanent part in his life, and in a way that she never wanted to be, and in a way that she knows is important to him.
Yeah.
And in a way that she refused to support.
And was always super jealous of him indulging. Oh, yeah. I can see why Charlotte's fixated on Robin. Yeah. Good point, Lindsay. You've convinced me. Do you think Charlotte has like a little scrapbook, like a secret hidden scrapbook where she puts every like article about Strike and Robin? Like Janice. Does she have a Strike and Robin wall hidden in her closet?
I do.
You do. I think of Charlotte like defacing pictures of Robin with the little mustaches.
Oh, God. She's got like a burn book like from Mean Girls.
Robin Ellicott is such a
fucking ugly skank. But no, I love that. So she picks up on the second ring. Robin was absolutely just sitting on her phone waiting for that call with bated breath. And she would have known how long the interview would be and what time it started. So I'm wondering if the hour-long delay of the debrief gave her a hint that maybe he was successful, or made her worried that maybe something had gone wrong. And
that would be me worrying.
Worrying?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Worried that Creed had gotten hold of a sharpened toothbrush. Yeah. Or... yeah.
Yeah.
But luckily, Strike wasn't shanked.
Strike is worried that they aren't going to be able to figure out the clue, and that all he'll be able to give Brian Tucker is confirmation that Creed killed Louise. And I think that's exactly what Creed's intention was. But too bad for him that Strike and Robin are so much smarter. And also Brian Tucker, because Brian Tucker already knew that this was a place of interest, right? So I think Creed really underestimated him.
Oh, yeah.
He made him a joke and he never took him seriously. And
no one ever really took Brian Tucker seriously. And they absolutely should have. I mean, he narrowed down where his daughter's body was to two places.
And he was right.
That's amazing. And he was right. Creed is such a narcissist. He absolutely believes that he's the smartest person in the room, that everyone else are idiots, and that he's, you know, a puppeteer playing with his puppet strings. It gives me such glee that he's so quickly proven wrong. I love it. And when Strike worries, he's like, if the clue's unsolvable, I'm like, clue, meet Robin, bam, solved.
I just hope that it gives Brian Tucker a lot of comfort or satisfaction that his efforts made a difference here.
I think when Robin tells him that, yeah, he was right, and that he was the reason they were able to find her so quickly because he had the Archer Hotel, I think there will be a lot of frustration there that no one listened to him for so long, but also a lot of gratitude that finally someone did.
Yeah.
Yeah. No wonder he's all over the TV talking about giving them knighthoods.
I know. The conversation that Corbin and Robin are having, though, it's a little bit frustrating for me reading it because they've already figured it out, but, you know, they're talking around it, so we don't know.
Just say it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they have a debrief. What are the points that they go over here? They start with Joanna Hammond.
Robin had been to the British Library and found a photo of Joanna Hammond.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to explain this whole bit because you actually got something that I didn't.
Yeah.
When Strike asks, and the holy, I wasn't sure what that was referencing, but.
Right. Because you think it's going to be about the holy place, right?
Exactly.
But it's not. It's about. He's asking if the article about Holy Basil was on the back of her obituary, because when he was in Janice's apartment, he saw her rifling through her papers and she showed him an article for Holy Basil. But when he realized that, oh no, she just keeps the obituaries of all the people she's murdered, he's like, who was on the back of that Holy Basil? And they figure it out. So they know that she has Joanna Hammond's obituary and thus murdered her.
Yeah, that was a great thought. And actually, I went back and found it. And the bit from it, they really pointed out. It says, she flipped open the folder and began looking through the clippings, some of them yellow with age. See, I saved that for her, for Irene, said Janice, holding up an article about holy basil, supposed to help with digestive problems.
I bet she just annoyed Irene so much with, oh, this will definitely help with your digestive problems.
But it's not true.
No, it's not. Yeah.
She's hiding the clue with more humor about Irene.
Yeah, it's a very clever, tricky clue. And the red herring about the holy place, it's a fun clue.
That was fun. I liked it.
So Robin found a picture of Joanna Hammond. She had a large mole.
Yeah, I was just wondering how that connected to Schmidt.
Well, it's because he said that the having a mole on the cheek is a sign of being a Scorpio. So because she had a mole on her face, Talbot was like, oh, she's not a Sagittarius. She's a Scorpio, which means that she's the death that Margot was worrying about the whole time.
And Robin confirms this by finding a picture of her.
Picture of her with a mole. Yes. But also, Strike would have seen the picture on Janice's wall, right? Yeah. One of the photographs on the wall shows the toothy, beaming brunette bride.
Yeah, but he wasn't looking for it, right?
No, yeah.
And I mean, that's what he says, that he basically admits here that he should have paid more attention to the astrology stuff, especially after Robin found out about Schmidt, because they might have gotten there sooner.
Yeah, you should have, Strike. Like I've been saying all along. I just like to note that even though Strike admits here that he should have gone back and reinterpreted the astrology stuff, He still, like one page later, starts groaning and interrupting Robin when she mentions astrology as the key to Creed's stupid serial killer clue.
I mean, so am I.
Yeah, I know.
Strike then calls Douthwaite, and this tiny interaction with Donna is so funny to me when she's like, it's him. What do you mean, who? I'm just imagining that Donna and Douthwaite have argued and talked about Strike every single day for almost a month. Just talking and arguing about Strike every day, kind of like I do.
That doesn't sound familiar at all. Definitely. I don't know what that's like.
No.
Sounds like a day ending in Y.
I was kind of surprised that Donna hadn't kicked him out.
I don't know. I feel like she probably just believed him.
Yeah.
Because I mean, he was telling the truth. He didn't kill anybody.
But still, the lying about your name. I wouldn't be happy if someone else came up and told me, by the way, your husband's living under an alias and was a suspect in a murder several years ago.
Sure. Yeah. I'd be like, tell me everything.
Yeah.
Strike tells Douthwaite what he thinks happened at his last appointment with Margot. And again, it's frustrating to read because I was like, what happened? But
I'm generally really impressed by the way Erling writes these bits where the characters know the murderer, but we can't know yet. So she uses all of these little tricks. She uses them to sort of get around telling us what's happening. And usually I think she does it quite elegantly. There's one bit later on this chapter that feels awkward to me, but we will get to that later.
We do get another musical reference here, a song reference that I think is really funny because Strike can hear Blame by Calvin Harris in the background. What a good song choice for Douthwaite. The lyrics are, so blame it on the night, don't blame it on me.
It's so good. You kind of have to blame it on Douthwaite a bit. Back 40 years ago, I wouldn't have blamed him much. But at this point,
I'm trying not to do the thing that Robin says not to do by blaming people around the killer, but it's really hard not to do that with Douthwaite because it's not like with Vi Cooper where she's being blamed for not knowing. He knew.
He knew and didn't say anything. Yeah, it's a totally different situation. My thing is that this is ridiculous because if 40 years ago he'd gone to Talbot and been like, listen, I think my neighbor was poisoning people, including me, and that Margot was on to her, Janice would have been caught. Douthwaite could have totally spun it to the press to make himself look like a hero slash victim. Like, you can't tell me that he couldn't have gone and given an interview saying that, oh, this woman was murdering people because she was so in love with me, but I caught her and I delivered her to the police. He would have gotten fan letters and dates out of that. It was the running that made him look bad in the first place, wasn't it?
Yeah. Again, I wish we could see this trial and some of the media coverage because you know the media is going to talk about exactly that. They'll probably show pictures of him side by side back 40 years ago and current pictures.
Oh, that's going to be rough for him. Ouch. I wonder how Janice is going to feel when she sees him on the stand and been like, him? That's... Or maybe
who knows? Maybe she'll be smitten. Yeah. Do you guys think that Douthwaite takes Strike's advice and tells Donna right away?
He'd have to be an absolute idiot not to tell her. But, you know, he didn't win any awards for brains in the first 70 years of his life or whatever.
I think at this point, the thing that should freak Donna out the most is if Janice had ever figured out where they were, she'd probably would have killed her.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that would have considered that. Oh my God.
She would have. She totally would have killed Donna.
She totally would have.
Yeah, Donna got a lucky break there.
And I would have been mad that, you know, you didn't tell me that she has a history of killing all your girlfriends.
Right? Like if my husband has a history of every single woman he sees dropping dead at some point under suspicious circumstances, like whether it's him or not.
You want to know about it.
Yeah, so I can get the hell out of there.
And I love the way Strike ends the call with just see you in court then. So good.
See you in court.
I don't know why it's attractive. It just is. It's just the confidence and kind of the cockiness of it all.
Like, it is cocky because he hasn't actually proved that he's right yet. Like, he doesn't have a confession. He doesn't have the body. He's just like, yeah, I'm right. We'll see you in court.
Yeah, she hasn't even been arrested and he's
honestly, yeah, see you in court. He has some serious BDE. By which I, of course, mean big detective energy.
Of course.
I don't know what else I could mean.
Besides dad, right?
Oh, yeah. Big dad energy is the other one.
Mm-hmm. Of course. That's the only two things that you're talking about.
The only two D's we care about. So after he's done, after that BDE moment, Cormoran calls Robin back. And this is the bit that I love so much in this chapter, because he's trying to tell her all his little Dothraite news. And she's like, Cormoran, listen to me. I'm a genius.
This is actually a really nice parallel, because just a few chapters ago, after Robin leaves the Vintry, mm-hmm. Strike calls her trying to tell her news about Douthwaite, about finding Douthwaite. And she's, I hate to interrupt you, but I got better news about Creed. This exact same thing is happening again.
I love that for her. I love that for us. I want this to happen every other chapter in the next book, because it's my favorite thing in the world. Also, I love the fact that, so Strike's call with Douthwaite was like a 5-minute phone call tops. And how much do you want to bet that Robin had 4 minutes, 30 seconds to spare after solving the clue? She got off the phone, instantly solved it, and was like, God damn it, Strike, get off the busy signal. I got to tell you the clue.
She's got that big detective energy too.
Yeah, they both have an absolute boatload of BDE. It's amazing. So I just love this conversation so much.
You've already mentioned the astrology part a little bit before, but it's hilarious. And when she starts to tell him it's a cluster of stars, and he's just like, please, no more astrology.
We're so close to the end of the book, Robin. Please don't tell me anymore.
But I like how she calls him Strike here. So, you know, she's probably both exhilarated and warning him not to start. You know, there's that listen to me.
Yeah, that is adorable. And I love it.
I love that she feels comfortable enough to,
that she's letting him know that he's annoying.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I love that.
I did find something that I think could possibly be what Robin found about the M54, because it says that this image was released on the 10th of September, 2014, which would have been just 8 days before this is taking place.
Ooh.
And it also says right underneath that it's called the Archer as well. So this, we can put this in the show notes. It might be what Robin found.
Oh yeah, that absolutely could. And it says, big bold letters right at the top of the screen, the globular star cluster Messier 54 in the constellation of Sagittarius. Literally the first words on the page.
Yeah. And if you scroll down right below it, it says the Archer in parentheses.
The Archer.
But again, just to give some more credit to Brian Tucker, I don't think that Robin would have, this might have pinged her interest because of the astrology connection. But if she didn't know the word Archer, mm-hmm. I don't think she would have made the connection with the hotel, because I did a search for the word Archer in the book and it doesn't appear anywhere in the Demon of Paradise Park. So I think that that is mostly Tucker's knowledge.
Yeah.
So had he not told Robin that, she might not have put that together right away or ever.
No, she'd have had to do like deep background work to get the same knowledge. And she has it at hand and can make the connection because of Tucker's work and all the effort he's put in.
Yeah, it just really gets me in my feelings. I mean, both of these cases do, Margot and Louise, because mm-hmm. I don't know, for me, there's nothing quite like a cold case being solved. It just, the feeling of justice prevailing after so long and the people who never gave up hope. I think it's one of the reasons why Trouble Blood has been my favorite so far.
Mine too. I really love this bit in their conversation where Robin says, think this through, and then walks Strike through the logic of what happened on the night in question. Because to me, that's such a detective thing. And I'm fairly certain he's done that exact thing to her before. Like, think it through with me. Walk her through the logic. And now my girl is doing it, and she's a grown-up detective, and she's leading Strike through the logic. I'm proud of her.
And it's another, just another way of also demonstrating how Robin's attention to detail as far as the victims in this particular story anyway, you know, she knows everything about Creed's victims. Her knowing that and her remembering that is part of what enables her to put that clue together.
This bit with the long distance phone call is the one bit that I find to be phrased really awkwardly in like the sort of don't give the game away phrasing, because they both know who he's calling. So he would have no reason to say make that long distance phone call. No reason except just to be awkward and to sort of give us a clue. If at this point you wanted to figure it out, you could pull up a time zone map, look at who's 3 hours ahead that we've heard of and be like, oh, Dubai. Kevin's involved. But at this point, who the hell is going to be pausing their reading to try and figure out clues? Not me. Absolutely not.
No. I don't know if I found it awkward. I was just like, who is it?
Yeah. I just think it's the one thing that in a realistic conversation, they wouldn't phrase it that way. Everything else I felt really natural for two people who knew something to be saying, but just this one line. Maybe it's just me.
I thought it felt a little awkward too.
Oh, thank you for the backup, Kens. But, I mean, necessary. You got to give the little hint and you can't give it away.
Shrike says he'll be back later on and they can talk everything through. You know that it doesn't matter how long he takes. She is not leaving that office until she sees him.
Oh, absolutely.
This is where I like to imagine him telling her what happened with Creed. And I also like to imagine that there's a parallel of when he sees her in the blue dress, right? This is Robin's moment that he's looking particularly sexy.
I mean, I absolutely believe it.
What if we actually do get a parallel for that? That's not a crazy thought, right?
No. I mean,
she is going to start thinking more about her attraction to him. So why wouldn't we?
I'm already dead.
I am already losing my mind over which hypothetical scenario will have him looking particularly sexy in the next book. I don't think I can handle it.
If she uses that exact phrasing, just rest in peace.
Put it on my gravestone. I'm out. Mark that down on the book 6 wish list. I'm picturing like him wearing a tuxedo like James Bond and doing something really intellectually powerful or physically powerful or both, like wrestling someone and outsmarting them at the same point in a tux.
That's a very specific fantasy.
Yeah.
I almost think that it'll just be something that he says or does, because I think that would fit in line with kind of their initial attraction to each other. Mm-hmm. So with him, we know that it was immediate physical attraction. He thinks about that sweater that she wore on the first day. So it makes sense that a dress would ping that. But for her, it's, you know, who he is that is growing the attraction. So I don't know. I'm begging you, Joe, please.
My ideal would be for it to like reverse. And she has a moment where she is just particularly thirsty for all of that. And he has a moment where he's like, oh my God, your detectiving is so sexy.
Yeah, I could get behind that too.
Yeah. Like, yes, just please. All of it. Just, oh my God, this episode's as bad as the last one now. Someone suggested that we get cold showers. Thank you for the feedback. I tried it. Doesn't work.
Okay, let's go on to chapter 70.
Where Robin and Barclay find Margot's body. And the epigraph reads, "And lastly, death. Death with most grim and grisly visage seen." Interpretation? I think it's pretty obvious.
It is pretty obvious. At long last, they find Margot's body.
After a full year of searching, and it's here.
The opening paragraph is just beautifully written. I feel like I'm picked up and dropped right in it, because I think everyone can understand that type of chill when the sun is sliding in and out behind the clouds.
Yeah.
And it says, "And Robin felt shivery in spite of the sweater she was wearing beneath her raincoat, as though a cold wind was blowing up Albemarle Way, the short side street whose tall, unbroken buildings kept it forever in shadow." They kept it forever in shadow. It is true that that's how the street looks, but it feels very thematically appropriate for the truth we're about to discover. This is the place where this horrible secret has been kept in shadows for 40 years.
Wow. I'm so envious of Joe's ability to depict place like this, to make surroundings feel real.
It feels like we've come full circle here when it talks about Robin standing in the same place Janice had stood 40 years ago, waiting for Margot. Because Robin is really waiting for Margot to show up now too, isn't she? Janice stood there waiting to end Margot's life and to hide her away in secret forever. And now Robin is standing there about to bring the truth to life and return Margot to her family. And it just feels very poetic.
Incredibly poetic. I love that connection. Love it. I also like the way here that Robin is getting inside the killer's head. And this is sort of another example of coming full circle, I think. Partly because, yes, Robin's a great detective. She has insight into what other people are feeling, even 40 years ago. But tell me if this is a reach. But I feel like it's kind of like how Margot has been in Robin's head this whole time. And now Robin is going inside the killer's head. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Now that she knows who the killer is, she's able to get inside her head. She's no longer trying to figure out what Margot's last steps were. She knows she's trying to figure out what Janice's last steps were to find Margot.
Yeah.
Robin is thinking about Margot walking towards this place and wondering if she realized what was happening, if she was feeling the effects of the drugs and knew. And Robin thinks, possibly, Margot was a clever woman and that's why she had to die.
So sad.
And poor Robin, she just keeps trying to think of something else, because she goes from Margot to then Charlotte and Matthew. And Charlotte and Matthew are obviously wrapped up in her feelings for Strike.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, the article that she clearly read about Charlotte, it says it told her nothing she wanted to know. And I'm like, what is it that you want to know, Robin?
What could it possibly be? I find it a bit odd that the narration usually refers to Charlotte as Charlotte Ross, but the articles that we read about her call her Charlotte Campbell. So is this crappy journalism, or is it something else going on with Charlotte's identity here?
Yeah, I feel like there's something here because I've noticed this too, but I'm not quite sure what it is. If Robin is thinking it, is she trying to subconsciously remind herself that she's married? But it would be interesting to kind of go through and see when she's called Campbell and when she's called Ross and who is saying it.
I think that would be really interesting. Does Strike call her Ross?
I think he does.
I think he too is often trying to remind himself that she's married with kids.
We should go through and look at that because that is an interesting point, and I do think that there might be something there.
Speaking of crazy theories, which I feel like I'm always doing, but this line here, where was Barclay? True, Robin had arrived very early and technically Barclay wasn't late. Listen, I just wanted to mention this because I feel like Robin and punctuality or issues with punctuality or concerns about it are mentioned so many times in this book that it feels like foreshadowing of something to me. And I know that this might be crazy, but horses were mentioned a bunch of times in Career of Evil. So am I that crazy? Don't say yes. Kens, tell me if I'm crazy or not.
I don't know if it's foreshadowing. I'll refrain from calling you crazy out of respect for you, but I will say that it does do a great job of illustrating just how keyed up Robin is about finding Margot's body. It kind of reminds me when she's waiting for Strike in Lethal White right before, because they think that Chisel is about to fire them right before they find him dead.
Well, before I call you crazy or not, what do you think it's foreshadowing?
I don't know.
Her face right now.
It means something. I don't have to come up with things. Okay. What if the case in the next book hinges on someone being late to something, and that's the key or the big theme?
Well, wasn't Barclay late in Lethal White too when they were, well, not that he's late here, but didn't they have to wait on him?
When they were doing the grave digging, yeah.
What if they have to wait for Barclay a third time, but it's because he's dead? I don't want that. God. No, I take
don't
it back.
Put that universe, into the
don't
universe.
Listen to my words. I can't let that
The only
happen.
Bit of foreshadowing that I think it could be is just how Robin says that he's not late, she's early. And when Robin shows up in chapter 73, she asks Strike, am I late? And he's like, no, I'm early.
When are they both going to arrive somewhere at the same goddamn time? Maybe that's a thing, huh? We can move on.
Thank you.
Please stay grounded in reality, Pools. I am begging you.
Yeah, let's move on. Robin thinks about Theo, and I wanted to ask you both, what do you think happened to Theo? We know that Margot suspected an ectopic pregnancy. I'm guessing that it's likely she never came forward because she didn't want anyone to know she was pregnant, but there's this small part of me that worries that something went wrong and she never got help and died, because that could be dangerous if left untreated. So it has crossed my mind as a possibility.
I too very much worry that she died, because it seems like a pretty likely explanation for why she never came forward. But so does wanting to keep it secret, because she'd be in danger from her family if it got out.
Yeah.
So I guess only Joe knows.
Yeah. And it's not like Strike and Robin put out a public appeal for her. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd be curious to know if she ever came forward after Janice was arrested, because the prosecution would probably be very interested in her.
Yeah, if she's still alive, she might face the same fear that Douthwaite does, right? The fear of, why didn't you come forward? You're a coward, even though she probably had a really good reason.
Again, I wish I could see this trial. I have so many questions.
I do too. I just want to see a trial.
Kens, what do you think about Theo?
I wish I had something different to say. I also think it's probably, unfortunately, I think it's probably likely that she ended up not getting any treatment. I don't want to think about her like pulling a Douthwaite. I don't know. I'm leaning more towards her not getting any treatment.
Oh, we're an optimistic group.
Yeah.
But moving on to something a little happier. I love when Barclay shows up and he says that he's having a bit of deja vu. I just like the reminder that the three of them went digging in the Dell, because Robin, she says at some point that she felt like it had bonded them, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. That's the kind of thing that bonds you together.
It kind of reminds me of in Harry Potter when the three of them beat the troll, you know, and there's that line about there's some things you can't share without ending up liking each other.
And digging in Adele for a horse skull is one of them.
Absolutely it is. Listen, one of my most sincere wishes, and I have a lot of them, obviously, but one of them is for Barkley and Robin to go grave digging in every single book, because I love this. What? Is it an inside joke? Is it a trend? What is this? Whatever it is, I love it. I want them to get a spinoff. I want them to have a snazzy theme song like Grave Digging Buddies, Best Friends for Life.
You're going to make me cut that, aren't you?
I haven't come up with the second verse yet. Give me a second. Grave digging buddies, best friends for life, armed with their shovels, a flashlight and knife. Oh, that's pretty good. That's pretty good, actually.
How'd that go again?
Do you want me to sing the third time? Because I will.
Yes.
Grave digging buddies, best friends for life, armed with their shovels, a flashlight and knife.
I'm telling you right now, I'm not cutting that out.
Keep it. It's genius. I want them to have like a secret handshake that involves a shovel movement, like shovel, high five. I don't know.
What do you do for the knife part?
Well, for protection in case they're interrupted while grave robbing, obviously.
But like if they're going to have a secret handshake, are they not including the knife part?
Well, no, their knife is in the holster. Sheath. Knives are sheathed.
Can you make up a Strike and Robin theme song?
I'll come up with one for next episode. It'll be really good.
All right. I hope so.
Probably the same tune because I'm not that creative musically. So Carmen and Robin, they are so cute. We are all thirsty and they are mute. I'll come up with a better lyric later. I don't know. I couldn't run for cute. So I went for moot. I don't even rhyme.
That reminds me of when Phoebe singing her song, but she doesn't have words. So she's like, just.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's a lot of my singing.
The rest of this chapter is, I mean, it's sad, but there's some fun bits because we get some things repeated or she's pointing us towards some of the clues that were important here. I know we've pointed some of these out in previous episodes, but just to go over them again now, the first one is Claire.
Yeah.
So we notice when Deborah first sees them, she asks if they're from the social work department. And she said that she had phoned Claire. Barkley jumps in real quickly with, we can help with anything that Claire can. Clearly not wanting her to call Claire. It happens again later with Robin. They do not want Deborah to call Claire.
And at the same time, it's just plausible that they don't want a social worker interfering with their corpse hunt, right?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is the name of their spinoff.
The next one are these chocolate biscuits. Samhain is opening up the chocolate biscuits that are wrapped in foil. And I assume that these are the same biscuits that Janice brings out on a tray during their interview at Irene's house in chapter 20. So Janice had biscuits wrapped in foil and, you know, she's connecting
right. The
place where Margot's body is with Janice.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got Claire, we've got chocolate biscuits, and there's a third C.
The crack in the ceiling.
Yeah. When they go into the sitting room where the ottoman is and Barkley looks at the almost completed puzzle. In the episode where we covered chapter 38, which was Strike's visit to the Athorns, we talked about the possibility of this puzzle being a clue, a sort of the answer to your puzzle is here, is I think what I said. And I feel like maybe this is a little confirmation that it's right because their puzzle is now almost completed, isn't it?
That makes sense to me. I like that. Symbolic.
Good catch.
Yeah, we had also speculated that the unicorn horns on the puzzle made an X. Like X marks the spot.
I made that up completely out of nowhere, didn't I?
I love it though. I love it. It says that they're jumping over a rainbow. So, you know, maybe that one's not right, but I still like it better.
Maybe this is a different puzzle and Deborah really just likes unicorn puzzles.
It's been a long time, right? So it would make sense that she obviously wouldn't be working on the same one. So yeah.
Yeah, no.
Absolutely. Let's stick with it.
New puzzle. It's still the same. And jumping over the rainbow means they're at the finish line.
Yes.
Bam. Nailed it.
Barkley is the one who understands that she's in the ottoman.
Oof. And Robin is horrified by the idea. And I was kind of like, is it worse to have a body in the furniture rather than in the floorboards or the walls? Really?
I think so.
Yeah.
It's like she's not tucked away somewhere. She's in the room with you.
I guess I would be more creeped out by her watching from the walls.
Well, she's not watching.
I've watched too many horror movies where things are in the walls, fewer where they're in the ottoman. But also good thinking on Barkley's part. I feel like he really has the same instinct for detectiving that Robin and Strike mm-hmm. do. Like, he is also clever. He's also good with people.
Yeah, he really is.
And a crowbar.
I don't know. It's also just about this puzzle. It just seems like this puzzle is so precious to Deborah. You know, she doesn't want anyone to touch it, anyone to move it. There's this thing on top of the ottoman that's so precious to her, but she doesn't realize what's inside of it.
No, I get it. The ottoman is the place for precious things. I noticed on this read-through that the cloth on the ottoman has the pattern of a mandala on it. And I looked up the mandala. In various spiritual traditions, mandalas may be employed for establishing a sacred space, among other stuff. So I'm wondering if Willem put it there deliberately, just like he drew the symbols on the walls, right? And it's, yeah, again, to that, she's in a holy place. She literally is. Do we think that that medium is actually psychic?
No.
Well, but maybe.
But no.
Okay. Spoil sport. Strike.
Thank you. I take that as a compliment. I just feel so terrible for Deborah during this part because she's really starting to panic. It's obvious that Gwilym told her repeatedly not to open the ottoman. She wants to call Claire, but Robin won't let her. We talked last time about the Athorns being some of Janice's unwitting accomplices, but they're really more her victims, aren't they?
Yeah.
Victims whose lives are being affected by this crime 40 years later. It just feels like a real reminder that our actions have consequences and how one terrible act can cause so much pain for so many people years later. And now I'm realizing that I'm quoting Janice when she says later that actions have consequences, but, you know, not her, though. Her actions don't have consequences, just other people.
She's about to find out that her actions have consequences.
Yeah, it's just sad to think about how much their lives are about to change.
They're about to be hauled out of their only home.
The only way I can make myself feel better about it is thinking that they'll get an actual social worker who won't decide to kill them one day.
That would be a good thing, ideally, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, once their apartment isn't actually a crime scene anymore, at least they'll be able to go back to it, right? There's no reason for them not to.
No, of course.
And with a real social worker, they'll have some, you know, actual support, like you said.
Yeah.
Just an aside about this bit, but the way Barclay deals with Soane, I bet he is such a good dad. Like, he has some serious, talking about BDE, the big dad energy. He has it here, and it's great. It's so cute.
He is really good with him.
Yeah.
He's really good with him, but he's also firm.
Yeah.
And Strike was good with him, too.
Strike was.
Although Barclay has a little bit more.
He feels more comfortable. It feels more natural and comfortable with Barclay.
Yes. It takes a lot of convincing to get the Athorns to go into the other room. But once they do, it takes both Barclay and Robin, who puts all of her weight on the crowbar to open up the ottoman. I just love Barclay's little, "Where's Strike when you need him" line.
He's waiting to have his dramatic confrontation, Barclay.
But thank you, Barclay, for the just reminder of, you know, very large Strike with his upper body strength, putting all the weight on the crowbar.
Like his biceps flexing as he kind of, maybe his shirt sleeves are rolled up again. Yeah.
Well, of course, it'd have to be.
Picking up what you're putting down here. Sure.
It's not my fault. It's Barclay's fault.
Yes. Blame it on Barclay.
But when they do get it open, they see bits of bone. It must be such a strange feeling for Robin, you know, to have for a year this imaginary Margot in her head. And now here she is looking at what's left of her. Oof. Have you ever visited a cemetery or grave of a well-known person? It kind of reminds me of that, like Westminster Abbey, or when I was a kid, we went to where Abraham Lincoln grew up. And it's kind of, I guess, people from the past can feel like fictional people. So being confronted with real life places, it's just a strange feeling. And I feel like that's kind of what Robin must have felt. Yeah.
I get what you're saying.
I remember kind of having an initial cringe reaction when Robin sits down on the ottoman afterwards.
Yeah.
But the more I've thought about it, the more I feel like this is Robin physically connecting with Margot after a year of the imaginary one in her head. And, you know, now they're both in the same space, Robin and Margot, both at 29, and finally finding a conclusion here. It feels like closure for Robin's final month as a 29-year-old woman, a year where she's put things behind her and truly found herself. And I really think Margot was a huge part of that. So my feeling of cringe kind of went away. And instead, I'm left feeling like this was a really significant moment for Robin. There's just something there about Margot not being able to live beyond 29, but Robin is going forward. And I think there will be a part of her that will always carry a piece of Margot with her. And, you know, Robin's about to live her best life, isn't she?
First off, thanks a lot for making me cry. I really appreciate that. God, yes, it's so beautiful. And it's, again, it's all coming full circle and then moving on. It's the circle's closing. And you know what? I don't think Margot would begrudge Robin having a bit of a sit down.
No, she deserves it.
Yeah, I think Margot would be happy supporting Robin once more. Physically.
Literally supporting
her. Supporting yes. of the ass. Yes. Sorry, that took it from poignant to absurd again. My apologies. But yeah, physically supporting her in the same way that she's been emotionally supporting her all book. I need to go have a cry down, which yeah. is a cry and a lie down, but together. A cry down. I just invented it.
Oh, okay.
Very creative this chapter.
Inventing theme songs, inventing sayings.
Yeah.
Let's see what you come up with next chapter.
Grape digging buddies. Best friends for life.
I'm glad that Ken's remembered my theme song. Thank you, Ken's. I appreciate that.
All right, let's go to 71 and see what kind of theme songs you can come up with for Janice.
Oh, God.
Da-na. Da-na.
She's Jaws.
No, I invented that. How dare you? That's my copyright.
Janice is Jaws, swimming around with a little bit of poison. Okay. Strike finally confronts the killer, Janice, and the epigraph. Such is the face of falsehood, such the sight of foul Duessa, when her borrowed light is laid away and counterfeasance known. If I remember correctly, this was the epigraph that really made me want to talk about the epigraphs because it was so good. In The Fairy Queen, Duessa is this ugly witch who often disguises herself as a beautiful woman, hiding her true self from the world. So Duessa represents falsehood and deceit, the perfect epigraph for confronting this killer who hides behind a cheerful, friendly, and caring facade.
Oh, snap. It's
great.
It's excellent. I have nothing more to add to that. Absolutely brilliant.
When the chapter opens, if I had been paying a little bit more attention, maybe I could have got it because it mentions the train. It mentions the red door, but I was just trying to speed through as quickly as possible.
Yeah. At this point, you're just racing till you see the name and you're like, what? Mm-hmm. You got me again, Joe.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, of course. At this point, my brain's not functioning. I'm just a vessel that the words are going into.
Okay. So Strike's thinking about Margot's body. And can I ask a terrible question?
Go for it.
What happens to a body in concrete?
So I did try to find an answer for this. And the best thing I could find is that it would decompose, but more slowly, and that it might be mummified. I read that concrete is porous, so the moisture would sort of slowly seep out.
So that's what I was wondering about, because I guess where does it go? Yeah, that's what I've been wondering about. So is it like the concrete is full of
goo? Like you crack it open and there's a goo, like that would be very gross.
But that's kind of what I'm imagining.
Yeah, me
like
too.
Like it didn't come out of the ottoman. Sorry, this is probably people don't want to hear this, but I'm just very curious about how, like what's the science there, you know?
I found a story that was about somebody who had murdered someone and thrown their body into like a barrel and then filled it with concrete and then stuck it in some water. So I was reading this article and there were a few little bits here about putting a body in concrete. So if the concrete filling the drum was made properly, it probably helped preserve the body, making the ID process go faster. It's basically created a semi-sterile environment with little oxygen. There's a chance the murderers didn't allow the concrete to settle properly, in which case cracks could have formed and the body could have decomposed naturally. I don't know. I guess for the sake of argument, we can probably assume that the concrete was covering up most of the smell, even though it doesn't cover up all of it. I just can't imagine that the Athorns would be living in their flat for 40 some odd years and not notice the smell of a rotting corpse.
She had to have researched this, right?
I don't think they had Google in the 70s.
No, I mean Joe.
Oh, yeah. But we know that Janice didn't mix the concrete very well and it was still lumpy. So I'm imagining that the smell sort of seeped out a little bit over time.
It clearly was a little bit, right? If anything.
Yeah.
It's not the same as the whole body. I'm just way too interested in this, but we can probably move on.
That's just a horrifying thought. And those poor Athorns.
Oh, I thought you were saying Lindsay being interested in body disposal was a horrifying thought. I'm like, yeah.
That's what I thought too.
Super is. I'm afraid for my life.
Hey, I was interested too.
Part of Strike's mind is still in the Athorns' flat, dwelling on the image of the skull and the femur poking up through the concrete. I think he's doing that same thing that he did with Creed, where he's grounding himself in the victims. Because just before that, it talks about how Janice looks as kind and as innocent as ever. But here he is reminding himself of what she's done.
I read it a different way. But I mean, your reading is totally valid. I read it as like, it's a horrifying image that he hasn't really had time to process. And at the same time, he was told about it rather than seeing it. So his imagination is like going into overdrive, trying to construct what it looked like.
Kind of filling in the blanks.
Filling the blanks. And he can't get his mind off it because he hasn't actually seen it. But no, yeah, I agree that thinking about her victim grounding himself in that is very him.
Can we talk about how he does that later too, whenever she's talking about everything that she did later, like when she's talking and it'll be like, you know, said Janice who poured, you know, weed killer down Joanna's throat. Like, I love those little details where you're just reminded of how twisted she is.
It's just like what he did with Creed. Mm-hmm.
It's so interesting to read through this and compare it to the interview with Creed to see the ways in which Janice is similar and also incredibly different. Like, she doesn't have the grandiose narcissism. She's just a full-on sociopath, but she still has that sort of humility and the sort of practical looking at what's what, even though she's absolutely bonkers.
When he first goes into the house and she offers him tea and he says, yes, I was thinking, what?
What?
I think he wanted to catch her in the act, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Interesting. It definitely seemed like he knew that she was going to try to poison him. I feel like he probably wanted a way into her kitchen to see her poison stash for himself. And that was like a good way to get in there to follow her, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe he wanted to catch her in the act so that she's caught off guard or she's thrown or shaken a bit before he starts questioning her.
That makes sense too.
Yeah.
The whole thing about the tea though kind of confuses me, because was Janice poisoning the tea in maybe the same way she did the last time and went to drink it because he walked in? Or was there something different in the air about this visit? Like, did she suspect that her time was up? Shrike suggests a murder-suicide would be a hell of a way to go out. So she must have suspected something. I'm just wondering how.
I'm honestly not sure. She couldn't have possibly known that he knew that she did it.
Yeah.
Like, she might have been worried. Would she have risked poisoning him if she thought that he was suspicious of her but didn't know yet?
Yeah, I don't know.
But I'm wondering if there was something in his eyes that sort of expressed, like, I've got you. Mm-hmm. And she was going for her way out in a proper murder-suicide. But how could she think he would fall for it if he knew?
It could be that thing where she's just extremely reckless and she can't pass up an opportunity.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Oh, I would love to ask J.K. Rowling a ton of questions about Janice.
Same.
Or anything.
I mean, my list is 1,000 pages long, just like this book of questions I want to ask her.
But so they go back and then Strike looks at her murder wall in a whole new light now that he realizes what it is.
Yeah.
She's so sick.
Well, it's just her murder wall. Every serial killer has to have a murder wall. It's like part of the kit. Like, you sign up, you get your welcome kit. It's got your murder wall set up.
Do you buy that at Home Depot?
It's Killers R Us. Yeah, you got your chloroform, your rags, your duct tape, your bleach, your murder wall set up.
Strike thinks about how he's been guilty of the same biases that Talbot had, that Vi Cooper had, everything that Robin's been talking about, that we categorize people based on our past experiences. Kenz, were you the one who said a while back that he also could have not been able to see it because Janice reminded him of Joan? Because there's a mention here about cancers being intuitive, gentle, perceptive. It just reminds me that Joan is also a cancer. So maybe that's kind of confirming the bias that he had.
You know, I think that that was actually Clara that might have said that, but that totally makes sense.
Yeah. This whole chapter though, is just like one bomb being dropped after another.
Yeah.
With Strike dropping the Claire bomb on us, and then he immediately finds the hairdryer and all her poison stuff. He mentions the dates and the chocolates from Christmas. And then he mentions people having bowel problems around her. Just so many gasps for me in a few short paragraphs.
We're like, the Lambuna was innocent the whole time.
It wasn't the Lambuna. The
Lambuna has been exonerated, thank God.
The Free Lambuna campaign was successful.
Yeah, that the reputation of Curry doesn't get dragged through the mud by Janice's crimes. That's what I really care about. Justice for Lambuna. Do you think that Corman and Robin got Lambuna to celebrate? I just want them to have another curry and whiskey night. I'm all right.
Moving on, there's a line that says, she blinked at him through the lenses of her round silver glasses, which were far cleaner than Dennis Creed's. And I really like this little mention of Creed because it reminds us that Janice is just as much of a serial killer as Creed is.
More.
Yeah.
I like the little detail about her glasses are cleaner than Creed. To me, that kind of speaks to Margot was killed by a far more skillful killer than you ever were or something like that.
Yeah.
Janice is a better serial killer than Creed.
She's more put together.
I mean, if we're going to rank serial killers by skill, that feels like a weird thing to do.
So she's a worse serial killer.
The worse. She is more careful. She's been getting away with it. Well, she got away with it for a lot longer. Her glasses are cleaner, but her hands are also dirty. Oh, but we learn about the phone call, the mysterious long distance phone call.
Yes, it was two. Drumroll.
Kevin.
So we learn that Janice was lying about visiting him and she hasn't seen him in 7 years since her last visit when she poisoned her granddaughter with bleach.
Yikes. God, what the fuck is wrong with her? Who does this? God.
It's terrible.
Because she was annoying.
Yeah, it's just her reasoning is so horrific, like you said, Kins, because she's whiny and just wanted her gone.
You know,
just awful.
I call Cormoran a bad uncle, intolerant of kids, but you know, at least he's never poisoned his nephew with bleach.
You call him a bad uncle? I've never heard you call
that. I love him. Other people call him that. Okay. And I'm like, no, I get it. His nephews are shits.
I did think of this, you know, comparison, but I mean, just not liking kids doesn't make you evil.
That is correct. Yes.
It's yikes.
Yes. Feeding them bleach, however, definitely does.
Yes.
Yeah. Clear line there. I think that we've nailed it. Yeah. We're handling the tough ethical questions here.
Yeah. Can we talk about Strike recording her for a bit? Because I've seen some discussion about this and why he agrees to turn it off or why he wouldn't have tried to hide it better. Obviously, he was right to attempt to record, but I don't really know what the laws are in the UK about recording people, but the best thing he could do is to hear it, right? So turning it off is the best thing he could have done.
He wanted her to talk more than he wanted the recording. So I think that he needed for himself to hear what she had to say and needed to know that he was right and to put any little missing pieces or doubts to rest. And this way, at least he can testify to her confession, like if she agrees to confess. Whereas if he kept recording, there wouldn't have been a confession at all.
Janice the whole time keeps playing with her ring. And even though we learn that it's her mother's ring, I think it's just a nice little reminder of her kind of obsession and focus on marriage and romance and being upset that no one wanted to marry her. She seems so entitled to Douthwaite, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And I know that this is her motive for some of her killings, but I mean, other times it's just because she wants to. She says, I don't know why. I just like it.
A lot of her more personal sort of poisonings and killings are related to men that she desires, either as an attempt to win them or keep them, or as revenge for rejecting her. Like Johnny Marks, her very first victim, rejected her, right? Her husband, she poisoned to keep him. Douthwaite, she poisoned to try and keep him around. It seems like Janice is sort of fixed on the status of being desired and desirable. She wants all the trappings and attention and validation that come with relationships and marriage. And for Janice, marriage isn't really about love. It's an achievement. Mm-hmm. It's like something that you unlock, right? Isn't that what society teaches women though, or tries to, that when it comes right down to it, our biggest accomplishment is landing a man and getting that ring in that white dress? I just feel like that's a bit of female socialization that's sort of combining with Janice's very twisted psyche.
I hadn't thought about it like that before, but yeah, I agree with that.
So just continue on. Janice confesses to killing Larry, to killing his mistress Claire, to killing Johnny Marks. And she tells Strike all the details about how she did it. With Creed, the information had to be tricked out of him. But I don't know, with Janice, I kind of got the impression that she was enjoying telling Strike everything. You know, she pulled off all these clever murders and now she's getting to show off. I don't know. That's kind of contradicted a little later because Strike says that she seems to only really enjoy it when she gets to Margot. But it's just the sense that I got from her.
Yeah, to me, it feels like another example of her contrast with Creed. Creed's narcissism is a delusion, right? He needs to keep that delusion going and like he's playing a game, right? Even though he's in prison and has no power. But Janice is like, okay, well, I'm caught. I know that he's caught me because I know that Strike is a very good detective and he's figured me out. So yeah, all right, game's up. I might as well tell everything and hope to get my picture in the papers now, right?
There's this line here that I just love because it feels like something we could all say to J.K. Rowling when Strike says, "You're a genius of misdirection."
We really could, couldn't we?
Wink, wink. She put that in for herself, didn't she?
I like to think she did. A little chuckle as she added that in.
I'm a genius.
Oh, I'm gonna blow all of their minds. Yeah.
This next part makes me laugh when Janice is talking about not being as good looking as Irene, but that she wasn't bad looking, but she just didn't have what men liked. And Strike immediately just changes the subject because there's no good response to that. What are you supposed to say?
Well, what I would want to say is like talking about what men like, generally, funnily enough, what most men really like is not having their food poisoned by their girlfriend. And I'm wondering if she maybe ever considered trying that or giving that a go. Apparently not.
You know, I don't think she did. Yeah, no.
Well, I mean, that would have been my first dating tip for her. Don't poison the dude you're dating. But what do I know?
That's a good dating tip for anyone in general, I think.
It's a good first step.
Yeah, number one rule.
Strike then explains how when they first met, he thought that Irene had wanted to meet with Janice to control what Janice said, but really it was the other way around. And Janice confirms that and says she didn't do a very good job because Irene was blabbing left, right, and center. It's just funny to me that literally everyone is annoyed by Irene, even Janice, especially Janice.
Gonna adjust her dosage accordingly.
Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, no.
It's true.
The interview did help Janice in that it made her look really good next to Irene. Sort of got Strike on her side for a long time.
Oh, their first interview.
Yeah, their first interview. Yeah, Irene might have been blabbing left, right, and center, but, you know, it really served Janice by getting Strike on her side.
Yeah, it did.
You know, made her look really good in comparison. Kept her safe for a whole year, basically, because Irene was so goddamn annoying. The bit where Janice says she talks till you could throttle her. I just wanted her to shut the hell up for a bit. I think that's the most sympathetic Janice is this whole chapter, because,
she's not wrong.
Oh, dear.
You guys are terrible.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe so.
Speaking of the interview from chapter 20, though, we learned that Janice did make up the story about Leamington Spa, and she says that she did it to take their focus off of Kevin being examined. It really did, because, you know, they spent so much time trying to find Satchwell, and Robin went to Leamington Spa. Although I'm not sorry that she went, because what a treat.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Janice. Much appreciated.
Strike does mention Talbot here because Janice is so shocked to hear that Strike thinks that Talbot was on to her.
He left a strange set of notes, and all through them, he kept circling back to the death of Scorpio or Juno, which are the names he gave Joanna Hammond. 7 interviews, Janice. I think he subconsciously knew there was something off about you. He mentions poison a lot, which I think it stuck in his mind because of the way Joanna died. At one point, I was reading the notes again last night, he copies out a long description of the tarot card, the Queen of Cups. Words to the effect that she reflects the observer back at themselves. To see the truth of her is almost impossible. And on the night they hauled him off to hospital, he hallucinated a female demon with a cup in her hand and a 7 hanging around her neck. He was still too ill to string his suspicions together, but his subconscious kept trying to tell him you weren't all you seemed. At one point, he wrote, "Is Cetus right?" He called Irene Cetus. And eventually I asked myself what she could have been right about. Then I remembered that the first time we met the pair of you, she told us she thought you were sweet on Douthwaite.
The one thing that I find the most fascinating about all of that is when he talks about the Queen of Cups, it says that she reflects the observer back at themselves. And this is exactly what they've been talking about this whole time, where our own biases play a part in seeing the truth in people. And it's just extra difficult with Janice because she's so good at it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that this is about reflecting their own biases back on them. And I feel like you're going to argue with me about this, which I love. But I feel like this sort of reflecting the observer back at themselves I feel like there are little bits and pieces in this whole chapter that sort of reflect Strike back at himself too. And so what I'm talking about is the people she murders. She talks about Claire taking too much paracetamol for her pain and ruining her liver. And it makes me think of Strike not resting his leg, just continuing to walk and taking, you know, more pain pills to compensate. And that can damage your body. She talks about Larry being a walking time bomb because of his smoking and his eating. And Strike's smoking has been mentioned in this book. And previously, we know his diet hasn't exactly been the healthiest. And then some of the stuff when she complains about... So her complaining about men is completely delusional. But some of the complaints she levels about men, the same complaints could be made by some of the women's in Strike's past, and they might have just a teensy bit more reason to be complaining. Like when Janice says, "You took my sympathy and my kindness and let me cook for you." Yeah, she's delusional because she doesn't have a relationship with Douthwaite. But it sort of resonated with the line from Lethal White where Strike tells himself, you know, you could try not accepting tea and blowjobs from Lorelai. And then just the closing lines of the chapter, useful lesson for men everywhere, if you ask me, actions have consequences. And Strike's sort of been facing the consequences of determining to be alone and independent, right? He's been facing the consequence of, yeah, I'm alone and free, but also I'm kind of lonely in my little attic flat. And maybe it's not as great as I thought it would be. I don't know. This might be crazy, but I just feel like there's little flashes of reflection here. And I don't know if it means anything or if it's even real, but it bugs me every time I read the chapter. And I just had to say it. And I think he's making changes in how he thinks of things. And I hope he's going to quit smoking. And we obviously know he's not going to have determined solitude forever.
It's hard for me to see because, like you said, Janice's logic and her reasoning are so flawed. I can't see him taking any life advice from Janice at this point.
Yeah. Well, maybe he's lucky he didn't date any murderers because they would have.
Well, I mean, the relationship comparisons, you know, there shouldn't be anything for Janice to criticize, right? Mm-hmm. There's no real lesson to take away. So I don't see him taking a lesson away.
Yeah.
And then God knows I don't want to have a Lorelai debate right now, but.
No, I know. We're all sick of those.
Yeah, very, very. But I really see that more 50-50 than other people do. That's probably actually a debate for another time.
I think you and I are actually pretty close in our views on this.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one who was most wrong was Nina, to be honest. But
yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so I don't know. It kind of just gives me a little cringe reaction because Strike needing to grow in some areas. Yes, but saying that actions have consequences applied to that what I think it's really saying is that her murders have consequences and all of the people who have been left in that wake.
Yes.
So I don't know. I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I do. It's just, it's an uncomfortable stretch. It's like one that gives you a leg cramp for me.
Oh, that's such a good metaphor. That's talent. I agree. And yeah, the absolute irony of her saying actions have consequences at the end of that chapter when she's finally about to face some consequences for the actions she's been getting scot-free away with for 40 years. It's just interesting. I'd like to hear other people's opinions on this one, to be honest, because it's tricky to unravel and to know whether I'm seeing things. And like you said, Janice is...
I get it. I don't know if I'm fully there.
No, I get it.
And I don't want to hear any Lorelai arguments from anybody.
My lips are sealed.
I'm so sick of it.
Yeah, I know. I too am sick of the Lorelai arguments, to be honest. Okay, anyway, sorry for that diversion into Poole's brainland.
So Strike explained some other things that led him to Janice. People saying that Margot didn't like the nurse. There's the whole Fragile X thing where she knew the name. So many people being drugged. So he mentions Gloria, Irene, Kevin, Wilma, himself, Douthwaite. I have to wonder if Margot would have started seeing these things as well.
Mm.
You know, she already suspected Kevin and Douthwaite, but had she been able to keep looking, I wonder if she would have seen more.
Was Janice poisoning Wilma before Margot died or was that just after?
I know for sure it was after, but I can't remember if it was also before.
Mm. Yeah.
Have to look. We also get confirmation of something that we've been talking about a little bit. And that was that Janice did tell Irene that Douthwaite was gay, but not to throw Irene off of Janice's crush or obsession, but because Irene was flirting with him and she didn't want him to flirt with him. So we got that a little wrong.
I feel like we were close enough, right? Well, she didn't want Irene to know that she liked him for whatever reason.
Speaking of Irene, he asks her, "What are you drugging her with these days?" "It varies," said Janice quietly. "Depends how much she's pissing me off." I should not laugh at that.
I'm absolutely going to laugh at that because I'm a horrible person. But honestly, come on. If you were friends with Irene, you wouldn't kind of want to just a little bit of poison.
Oh, man.
But, you know, in the end, Irene survived.
Yes, she did. And she gets to eat spicy food again.
That must be heaven. To be able to go back to curry and feel great. Oh, man. Now she just really appreciates being able to eat a curry.
Yeah, she does.
But will she ever be able to eat Lambuna again?
Did she actually eat that or was he just a joke?
He was just joking. But, you know, Irene does get to be in the Daily Mail and everyone's fussing over Irene and she's getting a bit of sunshine for being an almost victim. So,
well, she was a victim.
She was a victim, yes.
Oh, but it's so weird when she starts to talk about Douthwaite, isn't it? With the flushed face, the deep breathing and getting emotional. Mm-hmm. And it says, "And not for the first time, Strike had reason to reflect on the extraordinarily unpredictable nature of human love."
Aww.
And I just thought, well, that's not love, is it? It's obsession.
Yeah.
Entitlement.
It's
crazy.
Talking about environmental storytelling, this line, "When the sun slid out from a cloud and the glass Cinderella coach to turn briefly like white fire and then turn back into the tawdry gewgaw it really was." I think that line speaks exactly to what you're saying, that it isn't love. Because when Strike was first at her apartment, he thought that Cinderella carriage spoke to her romantic heart, right? But yeah. Now we're seeing that that romantic heart is actually a shallow image of what real love is.
I actually really love that because I was looking at that line and I was like, that means something, but I couldn't quite place it. And yeah, I think you got it.
Yeah. So finally we get to lay out the events of the day of the murder and we know the facts and the timeline. So take a big sip of water and walk us through this, Lindsay, please.
Let's back up a little bit. We know that at this point, before Margot's death, Janice has already killed Johnny Marks, and that was her first victim. Do we know if there's any between him and Joanna?
Not that we know of for sure, but I'm guessing there might have been. Yeah.
Kevin's father had left her because he thought she was poisoning his food, which she was.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, as a little bit of a side note, I'm kind of mad that he left Kevin there, but that's another story. Yeah. She meets Douthwaite and becomes obsessed with him, and she kills his lover, Joanna Hammond. At this point, Douthwaite is talking to Janice more often, and she's poisoning him in small doses just to keep him around and to keep him needing her. Douthwaite witnesses Kevin having a tantrum like children do, and so Janice decides that she needs to murder her son in order to get Douthwaite to want to be with her.
Yikes. Big yikes.
Oh
boy.
Yeah. But because it's her child, she wants to create a history so it's not suspicious. So that's why she starts poisoning Kevin. And I can't even comprehend the level of evil that it takes for someone to do that to their own child. But at the same time, Douthwaite begins going to Margot for help with his health issues, quote unquote health issues. And that's around the same time that Margot examines Kevin. And so Margot started asking questions about Joanna Hammond's death because she's getting suspicious. She's putting it all together. I mean, she's an amazing doctor, but she would have also been an amazing detective. She too has big detective energy.
BDE. Absolutely. And yes. Big doctor energy.
Big doctor energy. Wow. Yes.
There's the third D that we were talking about.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Doctor. How could we have missed it?
And then, of course, Janice at the chocolates and realized that Margot was keeping them and likely going to test them. So that's when she agrees to go out with Larry. She gets the concrete and she talks out the reasons why she started visiting the Athorns. And it was basically because one day she thought it would be fun to kill them. But then she says, "Thank God I never did that." That part kills me though, by the way, that thank God I never killed them. Not because they're innocent, but thank God I had a place to put Margot's body.
Well, at least she's consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, she's consistently disturbing. Yes.
Consistently, completely lacking, yes, in empathy, completely sociopathic. Yeah. I wonder if the head trauma did actually contribute to her.
I find this part really interesting when Janice, she says that she just assumed she was being paranoid that Margot never told Douthwaite, but Strike says, no, you were right.
Yeah.
And she gets so angry.
You said the bit that gets you is, oh, thank God I didn't do that. This bit right here is the bit that gets me. When Janice says, that bitch, she said venomously, what did she do that for? She had a rich husband and a lover wanting her back. Why she got to take Steve off me?
Like he was hers.
Right? Well, that's one of the most insane things she said, because she doesn't seem to understand why Margot would try to stop Steve from being poisoned unless it was... Does she genuinely think Margot was trying to steal Steve rather than, like, stop a poisoner?
Save him?
She genuinely seems to think that Margot was trying to take Steve and collecting men.
Level of delusion.
That is... peak delusion for Janice for me, that line right there. Like, what the fuck are you talking about, lady? What?
She also tells the story of how it all went down, right? And I think that maybe we owe Larry a bit of an apology. We gave him a hard time last time, but she does explain that she told him some story about a poor family needing concrete. So
over their roof terrace? Okay.
Well, there is some sort of explanation is what I'm saying. He didn't ask why, because she gave him some story.
Yeah, right. I'm still going to be a bit hard on poor simple Larry.
Okay.
She had him deliver bags of concrete to a flat that she wouldn't let him inside, right down the street from where she works. And then her boss goes missing like immediately after. And that didn't make him be like, do these poor people really have a roof terrace that they need landscaped? Or was that maybe some kind of lie?
Yeah.
Okay, Larry. It's sus.
I'm just trying to be fair.
Yeah, it's very, very fair. Poor, simple
Larry. It's the Hufflepuff in me.
Oh, boy.
To go back to what I said just a little bit ago, it says that Janice seemed to enjoy telling how she killed Margot, as if she was killing her again by telling it.
Oh, just like how Creed likes reliving his crimes, eh?
Clearly proud of what she's been able to get away with. Margot has a whole folder.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say because some of the other killings also seemed very personal, but Margot was the only one who was killed because she caught on.
Mm.
So I feel like that would have made Janice angry on a whole different level.
Mm. Plus, there's the fact that Margot was the only huge high-profile news case. So it's not just Janice's personal anger towards Margot, but also the fact that all of the papers were all over trying to figure out what had happened to her. Like, we're talking about this mystery. And we know that Janice loves being the only one to know why something is happening, right? So all of that news coverage must have been like catnip to her. Like, she must have been loving every single second of that. It must have been the biggest rush of her career as a serial killer.
So then I think she took the concrete to the Athorns the night before, right? Mm-hmm. And then that day she visits a patient with dementia so that she knows that that patient will agree that she was there in the evening. So she's setting up an alibi. She goes and buys a movie ticket for a later show to give herself time, calls her babysitter, says she's going to be late, snuck in the back door of the practice and poisoned the donut.
Yeah.
And the whole time she's thinking that she's not going to get away with it, but that it didn't matter anymore because she wanted Margot dead. And she started liking the idea of being famous and in the papers. And that's probably exactly what she's going to get now, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe it won't be as nice as she thinks it's going to be. She's not going to like prison, probably.
This next part breaks my heart a little when Janice explains that Margot struggled once she realized it was her, because she knew at that point, right? I mean, she knew what was happening. And I guess there's some comfort in knowing that her death was relatively painless, but it's still really sad.
She must have been terrified in her last moments. I cannot believe how lucky Janice got with every single aspect of her plan. Like, the timing of it happened so perfectly because of, like, this confluence of events and Gwilym showing up to help her. That's insane. That's luckier than Bristow and Cuckoo's Calling, isn't it?
I do just feel so bad for him because he thought he killed her. And it seems like him painting the symbols, it's like he's trying to make up for it or make it better, make it a nice burial place, you know?
Yeah, he's like, he's trying to atone, to purify, sort of, making it holy ground for her, resting in a holy place. Not saying that the medium was right, I kind of am. And so was the astrological chart, might I add, that said she was in an upper floor. Team Irrational getting proven right again.
With irrational in the title, yeah. Janice then talks about when Douthwaite left that it broke her heart. And she calls him the love of her life. I mean, this is just insanity. She didn't have an actual relationship with him. It's just fantasy.
She is obsessed. Like, she knows they could have been a couple. So I think she's not quite at the break from reality stage, but she has absolutely no comprehension of him having autonomous feelings of his own. She refuses to believe that he doesn't feel there's something there between us. Like, it's just circumstances keeping them apart. Super delusional. No empathy. I gotta think that her early brain trauma might have broken something in there that was... Because she says she remembers she loved her mother. She might have had some empathy at some point. I'm just really curious.
But it might just be that thing where we want to find a reason so it makes sense to us.
Yeah, that's true. I wonder why I'm so eager to find a reason for her, but not for Creed. But I am more curious about Janice's. Is that my own biases coming into play? Possibly.
I didn't say a word.
You didn't say a word. Yeah, I heard you not saying a word. Heard it all loud and clear.
She poisoned her granddaughter with bleach.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yikes.
And lastly, she talks about how she killed Julie Wilkes, that she was the only one she did without drugs because she was so angry that she, speaking of obsession, that she tracked Douthwaite down. And how dare that he was with another girl. This is why I say Donna should be
very grateful got her escape. Yeah.
And doesn't it feel like when Janice approached Douthwaite the next day and said, terrible about that girl, it's like she's telling him, right?
Yeah. He must have known she did it. Like, he must have known.
Oh, she's lucky that he was such a coward.
She really is. So this line... When she relates how she talked to Douthwaite at the Butlins, she turned slowly redder than she'd been all interview. Her eyes watered with the intensity of her blush. There's that troubled blood, the peak troubled blood. She'd been blushing all interview, but now it's lighting up her face.
It's just so funny because when we heard Fairy Queen troubled blood and that it means blushing, that is not the where I was going.
We
with
thought
that.
Like I thought Robin was gonna be doing some cute blushing when Strike kissed her. Nope.
Yeah. God. Thanks, Joe.
I'm so excited to learn what the title of book six is so I can get it totally wrong.
I know. You know, you should just tell us what the title of book six is so we can start guessing incorrectly.
Me?
No, Joe. I'm just talking to Joe, pretending like she can hear.
Maybe she listens.
God.
We get actions have consequences, as she is about to learn.
Yeah, that whole ending is just, she's
a little bit rich of her, isn't it?
Very rich.
It's a lot of it. Yeah,
it's quite a bit unhinged. It's not fun living here all on my own. It'll be funny seeing Irene's face. I'll be all over the papers, won't I? I'm like, well, at least she won't have to hang out with Irene anymore. I bet the other inmates at the women's prison will be a peach compared to Irene.
What if Irene wants to come visit her?
Oh my God. Her only visitor.
Oh Lord.
Her only visitor is Irene.
And Janice is torn because she doesn't want to see her, but at the same time, it's her only
visitor.
And she
can't even poison her.
This is how I want Janice to be tortured for forever, is Irene has to come visit her.
I very much
hope. That's her eternal punishment.
Yes, that Irene comes to visit in prison punctually every single Sunday or whatever after church. Yes, please. Fingers crossed. We're so mean to Irene. Sorry, Irene.
I know, but...
All you ever did was be annoying. You never fed anyone bleach.
But here's a question, though. The last victim that we know of is Guillerm, right? Do we think that she's killed since? Because it seems like for a person who likes to kill, that she wouldn't have stopped.
Well, we do hear in the next chapter about some possibilities, right? It says a trickle of relatives suspicious about the way their loved ones had died under Janice's care soon turned into a tide. Exhumation orders are made. And then this other quote, the police are confident they're going to be able to get forensic evidence out of other victims' graves, even if Margot's results are inconclusive. Janice had her ex-partner Larry cremated, but his lover Claire was buried and she's being exhumed. So Claire's being exhumed, but it says other victims' graves, plural. So it seems like there are definitely other possibilities there. Yeah. So I think, yes.
Oh my God. I wonder I wonder what the final number was.
I don't think they'll ever know unless Janice has kept track. Maybe if they count up her obituaries.
Oh my gosh.
But she has a whole big folder of them.
She keeps every single one. So they go through. Oh my gosh. Again, I need to see this trial.
What is her like serial killer name?
Well, doesn't it say they're calling her the Poisoner Granny? Which isn't that good a name.
I think it should be something with a nurse in it.
Yeah.
If you guys were to come up with a cute little serial killer nickname for Janice, what would you come up with?
The Naughty Nurse.
That sounds like a Halloween costume.
It is. From an earlier chapter, full circle. Coming back on it.
Oh, man.
The Poisoner Granny. I mean, I guess she's a grandma, but I feel like something with nurse would have been good.
Or something that rhymes.
I don't know. I'm not good at that.
Now, that's a fun question. We should reach out to our listeners for that.
What would yours be, Kenz?
Oh, God. I can't come up with cute alliterative shit. I have no idea.
I mean, Naughty Nurse is the best suggestion yet. I haven't heard better.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, let's put this out to the listeners. Let's come up with some more nicknames for Janice.
Yeah, what would be a better nickname than the Poisoner Granny? And what would Irene and Janice talk about on this hypothetical
Yes, visit? Please. I want that to happen so much. It's my headcanon now.
Well, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of the final chapters of the book, chapters 72 and 73. If you enjoy what you've heard so far, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod with regular updates announcing future episodes. If you'd like to send us a response to anything you've heard or have something you'd like us to discuss on the show, you can always email us at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.
Grave digging buddies, best friends for life, armed with their shovels, a flashlight, and knife. They're out on a corpse hunt, they're digging up clues. For all of you villains, it's very bad news. So if you're a killer, you better beware, 'cause these grave digging buddies make a hell of a pair.